Episode 810, My Strength is My Story with Kara Brookins. Rise, How a House Built a Family.
Moms, needing a little inspiration and a ray of hope? You've come to the right place. This is the show that you can turn to for just the pick-me-up you need. This is Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. Here's your host, certified life coach, personal trainer, and nutritionist, Christiane Wargo. Staring at a stop
sign, watching people drive. Happy, happy day, and welcome to My Strength is My Story. It is a beautiful day, and I am so excited to share with you Kara Brookins. You are going to be blown out of the water. You may even need some tissue. It is an extraordinary interview with an extraordinary woman. I promise you, you will be touched today. For those of you who are brand new, maybe you're coming in, you know Kara, welcome to the family. I'm so delighted of your presence. If you already haven't had the opportunity, you want to head on over to createyournow.com where you can learn more and sign up for the Kisses newsletter, the Keep It Simple Strategy Everyday Solutions to Live, Love, and Impact. Oh, you are going to be impacted today. Kara Brookins is an incredible writer. Her words, how she strings them together, how she wrote this book in the home that she built in her library, Inkwell Manor. It is truly an amazing story. If you are one who says, I'm way too busy, oh, no, 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 just wait. This mom of four built a 3,500 square foot house with her four children. And at the time, her youngest was 2 years old. All of your excuses are going to be shattered. Today is your day. Tune in and let's listen to Kara Brookins' Rise, How a House Built a Family. Hello and welcome to Create Your Now. My Strength is My Story series is happening and I am so excited. Today I have the honor of chatting with a phenomenal woman who is going to share with us her magnificent journey after losing everything. Yet she found a way, the strength and the courage to heal and build a new life. I'm speaking of Kara Brookins. She is a mother of four beautiful children, a computer analyst, and a social media marketing expert based out of Little Rock. When she isn't wearing all of those hats, she's had the time to even author approximately, I think it's 7, middle school grade and young adult novels. Her latest debut memoir is Rise, How a House Built a Family. Kara, welcome. Come on in.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here today.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you. I just got to tell you right now, I have read every single page to your book, front to back. And then I've marked some things. I've taken notes. This is beyond just a memoir. I mean, this is a journey. It's a novel. It, at times, I almost felt like it's got to be a fantasy. This isn't for real. But this is truly your memoir. This is real life.
It was my real life, and there's even a photo album in it, which is my favorite part. So many parts of that book were so hard for me that, you know, by the time we actually got to publication and they decided to put pictures of my kids in it, it made me so happy because no matter what dark stuff is in that book or good stuff, there's always these pictures of my kids that can make me smile every time.
Yes. And so
best part.
That's right. It's the best part. And you'll have to pick up your copy because I'm not going to show you all of them, but there are pictures. and you will love them. I absolutely adore them. And of all your children, oh my goodness, Hope and Drew and Jada and Roman, correct?
Roman, uh-huh.
Oh, whew, I got them all. I don't know.
Yeah,
between
gold
you
star
and I,
for that.
That's right. We have 9 children between the two of us. We're almost to a football team. Are you ready to dive
in? I know. It makes me tired.
Well, we could just
but
make
that was
it a
my
party.
Biggest goal in life was to be a mom. I always wanted to be a mom. I never imagined I'd be lucky enough to have 4. I always thought a couple. So I feel so fortunate. I love it. I love having a pile.
Oh, well, they are tremendous. And I know they're leading amazing lives now. But tell us a little bit about where you are right now in your life.
Right now, it's this strange transition time after a book comes out about your life and knowing that people all over the world know your story. So we've been kind of in the middle of a media whirlwind with camera crews and interviews everywhere. It's been sort of crazy, but all in good ways. And now it's deciding, we're right at this sort of cliff, this decision point of feature film and, you know, maybe some more television stuff. So it's a real change in direction for a girl whose goal was to sit all alone in this library and write books. You know, that's what spurred this. That's what my goal was, to do that. So to instead have my future look very public is new. I'm settling in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, settling in. I think your life is just getting started. And I can only imagine the climb to Mount Everest, but I know you'll have some mountains and valleys along the way. But girl, you are headed to the top. I just know you are.
Oh, thanks. It's a long journey here. I can tell you that. Mm-hmm. Long journey.
It is. And you mentioned that you're in your library, and you're speaking of the home that you built, Inkwell Manor.
That's right. I built it with my kids and named it Inkwell Manor with the idea that I would be a full-time writer and that all of my future books would spring from this place. So I've actually written, I have an adult suspense novel that I wrote from here, and three of my young adult novels were written right here in this library, as well as Rise was written here.
Wow. That's incredible. Just, I mean, to think that, so you have 8 books total now so far that you've authored?
Right. 8 total.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I better get reading because
I should clarify that. 8 published. There's still a couple that are manuscript form that I hope will be out soon. So there's a couple more. And then there's a couple that are manuscripts that should never come out that are like in a bottom drawer.
Were those one of your first experiences?
Well, not all. No. The first one I wrote was published, was a middle grade novel, Doris Free, and that was published. Uh-huh. But there were a couple of experimental things that I wrote along the way that I just decided, no, this is not what I should write, or I did this very poorly, and no one should, this should not see the light of day. And you have to have those failures. I learned more from writing those. Mm. One of them is a screenplay. I thought, I'm going to write a film. I can do this. I've written a couple of novels. Yeah, I probably should not write screenplays until I have at least until I have a bit more instruction. So, you know, you learn. But I learned so much about storytelling from doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. So those are just as valuable to me as the ones that are sitting on the shelf.
Mm-hmm. Your failures have become your success.
Without a doubt. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're stepping stones.
Yes, beautiful.
You got to have something to throw down in the mud to stand on to keep your feet dry.
Mm-hmm. And you've been in a few mud puddles in your life.
I have been in the mud. I'm not afraid to get dirty, but I never imagined I would get quite so dirty as digging a foundation of a house. I never imagined that.
Yeah, yeah. You guys have got to pick up a copy of the book, Rise, How a House Built a Family. It is beyond an extraordinary read. You will be on the edge of your seat. I kid you not. There were times at night that I was reading this, and I had to finish the chapter, even though my eyes were falling shut, because I was like, oh my gosh, what is going to happen here? Because I can't explain it. The rise and the fall of my emotions. I felt like I was invested in your journey. It was that well executed, Kara, and my hat's off to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was a tough one. It's still tough for me to read parts of it. Mm. I actually ended up narrating the audiobook, which remains one of the toughest things I have ever done in my life. You know, huge, huge difference from writing a book where you feel like as you're writing, you know, other people will read it and it will all be out there.
Yes.
And that's tough to know because you're not just telling the good parts of yourself. You have to tell the bad parts of yourself. Mm-hmm. You have to say, here are the mistakes I made and how they hurt everyone I loved. You know, that's part of the journey is owning that history.
Yes.
So, you know, as you're writing that in a book, you're aware people are going to sit on an airplane or a beach and read this story, but there's a whole other level of revelation, of exposure to saying these things out loud.
Yeah.
And to knowing people can hear the way that my voice just split and know how hard that was for me to say, to admit, how painful this was. And it was just a whole new thing. I really didn't know if I could get through it. It was 40 hours of reading in a little phone booth to produce a 10-hour audiobook with Macmillan. And it was tough stuff. But I am as proud of that as anything I've ever done in my life. Mm. And there's so much to be said for the things that we step so far outside of our comfort zone to do and think, I don't think I can achieve this. Mm-hmm. That when you do, there's so much pride behind it because, you know, I did something that was so hard and so outside of what felt like natural me, and I dove in anyhow. So when I got that first copy of the audiobook, which I confess I still have not listened to all the way through, I listened to about a quarter of it, and I will eventually listen to all of it. But when I got that and it said read by the author, I am just as proud of that as anything. Mm. Tough stuff.
When you hear yourself tell your own story, how has that healed your heart?
It's the owning of it. You know, I think that for women in particular, there's so much shame that goes with things like divorce, things like domestic violence, mistakes that we've made. We carry a lot of shame. Yeah. Some of it we put on ourselves, some of it comes from society. And the only way that I have found that you can just sort of dispel that and move on with a sense of power is to own it. Mm-hmm. And there's no better way to own it than to say it out loud to anybody who wants to listen for their entertainment, yeah. You know, and to get, it's not that you get super comfortable with saying it. I do motivational speaking, and every single time before I stand up and speak to a crowd, I have this moment where I think, oh, maybe I should just skip the bad parts today and just tell the good parts. Like, can I just do that? Like, haven't I told the bad parts enough? Do I have to stand up and look these people in the eye and say again, so here's some really dumb stuff I did. You know, it's hard because, you know, you're going to talk to people afterwards. That's and right. Look, it's hard every time, but it gets easier. And there is so much power in it, especially because there are so many other people who are saying that it releases them from guilt they felt just by reading it.
Yes.
You know, part of being a writer is I have the ability to string words together in a way that somebody who is not a writer doesn't. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there's a sense of responsibility, whatever your gift is, if it's music or whatever it is, you have a sense of responsibility to string those words together for people who can't, who their gift is something entirely different, is painting or something entirely different. Mm-hmm. But if I can say those things in a way that they can say, oh yeah, that's how I need to say it, and that's how I need to understand it. It's this connection, mm-hmm. you know, where we complete one another's circles and one another's healings. There's an enormous and beautiful connection in that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's why we have this series, My Strength is My Story, because a lot of us are running from our stories. We're running from the shame. We don't want to feel defeated, because especially now as society has twisted amongst and grown in technology and things, we only see the social media beauty, those, you know, highlight reels all the time, that nothing ever goes wrong. But as you well know, there are lots of mud puddles in your life.
And you don't know, you know, when this story came out, before the book came out, I didn't know, like, what would people focus on? Because you know they can take it in so many negative ways. And I had no idea what that focus would be. There was, you know, a year from the time of the book sale to the release of a tremendous amount of anxiety that comes with it because of social media exposure. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time on social media, but you know you cannot frame it. You cannot pre-frame it for people. They will take what they want and run with it. Mm-hmm. And while certainly we did get some of the negative, it was overwhelmingly positive. Yeah. But you don't know, and mm-hmm. and owning it comes with a consequence. You can't rein it back in with social media today. Once it's out there, you own it, like it or not.
Forever.
Right.
And sometimes you're like, I wish I could forget this and erase it, you know, and not talk about it. But it doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Yeah. But the strength that you gain in the telling and in the owning when it does go well, yes. you just have to ride that through the other times when you say something that is taken wrong or even that you worded poorly and you're like, wow, I shouldn't have said that. I didn't think that through. You also know, well, I'm just going to have to move on and kind of ride the positive when you can and sigh over the negative and keep going. You know, you can't let it own you.
Right, right. And you very much own the positive because you are born very optimistic. I mean, in your book, you say, I mean, Maybe I should say you're an extreme optimist.
You could definitely say that. My kids would agree with you.
But I think it's a beautiful thing. Don't get me wrong, because I kind of go along your shirt tails just like that, where you see the glass more than half full. You see that, oh my gosh, it really can be full. I can get to where I really want to be. In your life, Kara, you wanted to be a mom all along, but it wasn't all beautiful roses and the perfect white picket fence that you had dreamed. Can you take us back there to a little bit of your pain?
Sure. You know, of course, being a mom was my biggest thing. You know, in high school, when people are saying what their careers are, you know, I just want to say, well, I just want to be a mom, which of course you can't say, right. You know, in high school. Eye roll.
Right.
But that was my thing. Like, that's what I wanted more than anything. So, and I became a mom very young. I got married at 18 and had my first child at 19. And I did have this ideal sense of, you know, from everything from society and of course that, you know, we have growing up of you must have a mom and a dad to have the perfect family. Mm-hmm. So I carried that sense with me. And even when things were going very poorly in the husband sense, I married a man who became schizophrenic just months after we married. He came down with very severe paranoid schizophrenia, and the first few signs were small, but once he descended, he went into a very extreme case, actually, of schizoaffective, which is a combination of schizophrenia and bipolar. So everything is just compounded in a horrible way, and he was extremely dangerous, which people don't like to say about mental illness, but it can, not always, but it can be the case. Mm-hmm. So of course I tried to make that work because I was optimistic constantly. Oh, well, you know, there are medications that can handle this and, you know, there are things we can do. And that I tried and worked so hard to make that happen because of my optimism and my determination. And it wasn't until our lives had been put into danger multiple times that it was like, no, this, you know, truly is not going to work. Despite my ideal mom and dad vision, this is not going to work. And unfortunately, leaving that situation did not make the dangerous person go away. For the next decade, he continued to come and torment my kids and I. There was no place that we could go that he could not find us. So while that was going on, of course, I was looking for any possible way to feel secure, to feel safe. And again, I still had this ideal mindset of mom, dad, kids, we must have that to have the perfect family. And I was, as we all are, in search of perfection. Mm-hmm. And I met a guy who was very strong, who was very protective of me, mm-hmm. which was a very attractive thing to a person who's been afraid for years. So I married very quickly, only to find out that that strong, protective was also manipulative and became extremely physically violent. And I stayed in that situation for quite a long time, for 3 years, determined every day when I woke up, it was going to be a great day, that we could make this better, that this was going to be okay. You know, and I continued on that optimistic, I would say, despite extreme violence one day, I would wake up the next day quite happy. Mm-hmm. I still do that. You know, I know that, okay, these big things are in my future today and we're going to fix this and this can be perfect. Which, you know, you have to identify which things, whether they're strengths or weaknesses, they can act both ways in your life. And in this way, my optimism and determination, which can be aimed at very positive things, I had aimed them in a negative way. And I did learn to identify that. And once again, found myself a single mom, now with 4 kids. And realizing by that time, I had kids who were teenagers. I had a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old, and then the younger two, 11 and 2. So I started to feel this sense of urgency that I have these teenagers who are going to go out into the world, who have lived this life of terror, who are afraid, who are living very small, and who don't dream very big. They're just trying to get through today. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all in this survival mode. And we weren't this, you know, strong, powerful family. Like we like to think of people who have been in traumatic situations of all lovely and pulling together and working hard together. No, that's not what happens. Mm. What happens is you all pull inside of yourselves And you lose the ability to communicate together and laugh together, and you become very defensive. And that's where my kids and I were when I decided, in order to pull us all out of this, we have to do something big together. Mm.
And that took you to a secret vacation that you had planned in Hickory Haven.
That's right. I decided we had to have a getaway. Uh-huh. And I really would have liked that to be like at the beach or, you know,
sand and warmth and the toes. And,
yeah. Anything, but I couldn't afford that. So I live in central Arkansas, which in northern Arkansas are the foothills of the Ozark Mountains, which is beautiful, though not especially beautiful at Thanksgiving time. But it was something I could afford. A little cabin in the middle of nowhere I could afford. And it was away from the nightmare memories that lived in the house. You know, we're living among all of these memories, and our house was up for sale. We couldn't afford to keep it. We had to get away. Mm-hmm. So we went to this little cabin in the woods, and on the way there, I saw this house, and it was this big, beautiful dream house with these tall columns in the front and red curtains, and the entire top of it was blown off by a tornado. And I immediately pulled over because you could see these 2x4s that were sticking up like teeth. Mm. You know, it was this beautiful and also extremely destructive visual. And for the dark place that I was in my life, it was just perfection. And I pulled over and I could see, you know, just the inner workings of a house that we don't often have time to see. How often do you see what's inside of a wall? The average person doesn't see that.
Right.
And it all looked so simple.
Yeah.
In that I could recognize the things in there. It was like, well, that's just a nail. These are just boards. And that's just a regular old brick. So, you know, it didn't matter that I was just a programmer and my strongest muscles were right here from typing books and computer code. I had this idea that this is just simple stuff. And if I tried, I bet I could build a wall like that. Mm. And at that point, of course, I didn't think I'm going to build a whole house. It was a fantasy. You know, it was just this ridiculous pie in the sky fantasy idea. But once I, you know, started with the kids, we started building this little model house out of sticks that we found out in the woods while we were at the cabin. And from there, it just very quickly turned into, you know, from this, you know, what if and what would you build if you could build anything? What would be in your house? And it started as ridiculous things like, well, I'm adding a gold mine and a hot tub room and, you know, ridiculous stuff that it turned into. I want a hummingbird feeder out the window. You know, here's my coffee spot. Here's where I would read. And from there, it went to, well, obviously, we're going to build this.
Wow.
In just a few days, it pivoted to that.
Oh, and so you left Hickory Haven. This was over kind of Thanksgiving, if I remember correctly.
Right.
And you took and you made sure, because I think it was Drew who wanted to make sure that stick house that you had created was safe when you took it from the cabin back home.
Right. Right. It had become the symbol, you know, the symbol of a possible future. Mm-hmm. And when we left the cabin, I think it was still this fantasy, this dream of what if. Although I think that we had all determined in our mind, yeah, we're doing this. So we hadn't said it out loud. And there's so much power in saying things out loud that once you declare it, you have this different sort of commitment. And especially saying it out loud in the presence of other people who will either help you or hold you accountable. Mm. And my kids, in fact, were both because they were my work crew.
Yes.
Willingly, I have to say, they were my willing work crew.
Thank goodness.
Yes, you don't know what I would have done otherwise. But yeah, we had to preserve that dream until it became something bigger, where we were actually building the real thing.
Well, when did you actually know that we're going to do this?
We actually knew we were going to do it before we, you know, had the money to do it or figured out it was possible. But I may have mentioned I'm a little stubborn. I've got this determined thing just a tiny bit. Once I decide I'm going to do a thing, I very rarely change that goal. Mm-hmm. I may fail many times and find out, you know, this path isn't going to work, mm-hmm. but the goal's not changing. And it was very much that way with the house. You know, once we said out loud, hey, we're building this thing, right? And we all went, yes, we are. We took a step back and we drove to some different houses that we could afford because I was going to have to get a construction loan to buy the supplies. Mm-hmm. So for that same amount of money, which was about $130,000, what house could we buy? And we could, in our area, buy a house for that amount. But it would be small. Mm-hmm. It would definitely be retreat. It would be piling kids in bunk beds and corners, you know. Right. It wasn't the message I needed to send my kids of anything is possible. Mm-hmm. And you can have something big. Mm-hmm. And, you know, while I was being all philosophical and, you know, writerly, let's be honest, of, right. you know, I was looking for symbols in real life because uh-huh. I'm that kind of girl. My kids were really from the standpoint of, I want my own room. If I have to build it, I will build it. I want my own room.
At least they were honest. I mean, come on, give them that credit, right?
Right.
That's great.
So, and well, later they saw other benefits. Right. At the onset, it was not about that.
Well, obviously, you decided not to go the route of an already pre-built home. You decided right. to go ahead and get the materials. But first, you had to find a place to put the house. I mean, everybody needs a plot somewhere, right? A piece of land. How in the heck did you find that?
It was such a challenge because I had so little money. You know, I needed to own the land and I had very little savings. Mm-hmm. And in order to get the construction loan, I had to own the land free and clear. I couldn't borrow money to buy it.
Okay.
So to find land that we could afford, we were driving, you know, 30 miles out in the country and we all get motion sickness. So we're like driving to look at land and having to stop the car to let people get out because they're getting sick. You know, the kids are sick. I'm getting sick driving and that's a bad sign.
That's not
good. Every time we go home, we're going to throw up, you know? So it was really discouraging at first. And just by a stroke of luck, I found an acre of land that someone had put up for sale that week. You know, it was a last minute thing. They'd put a sign on the tree and I had a great bit of fortune in that the person who put it up for sale, their brother lived next door and wanted a nice piece of property to go in next to him. He didn't want someone to come in and build a little house or pull a mobile home in. It would raise his property value if a larger home went in. Yeah. So, you know, I showed him my plans and he called his sister and said, I recommend you sell it to this person. Well, I didn't have what they were asking. And, you know, they were asking $30,000. I had $10,000. And, you know, we settled on $20,000, which I had to scramble to come up with.
Wow.
But it was an incredible deal. Even at 30, it would have been an incredible deal on an acre of land in the area. So, and it was beautiful. From the first time we saw it, it was this, it looked like a national park, you know, hardwood trees that were trimmed up tall. It looked like home from the first time we saw it, and we could envision the house that we wanted to build on it. So it happened exactly as it needed to.
Wow. A big God wink there for sure.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Indeed. Well, you'll definitely want to pick up a copy of your book, Rise, How a House Built a Family by Kara Brookins. Oh, my goodness. We cannot tell all the stories that are in here.
I know.
We're highlighting a ton of them, but you got to read the details because this woman can write. She is incredible with her penmanship and the words. And as she was talking earlier, Kara, how you string words together, you do it with perfection. Definitely.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I have to ask you, so you got the piece of property. And I know we've got a lot of women, strong women here that listen. We've got some strong men, too. We love them, too. But primarily, they're women who listen. And you had to also get that construction load. I mean, finally, with the God wink, I mean, the blessing, you've got the land. You were able to now begin to build because this wasn't just a little house. This wasn't just 2,000 square feet. You were talking like 3,500 square foot house, two stories.
That's what happens when you let your kids help draw the house plans.
Oops.
Bigger, bigger, bigger.
Bigger. And the storage shed, too.
Right. Yeah.
And that wasn't different. Probably part...
And there's a two-story treehouse, too, because you can't stop. Yeah.
That's awesome. Did that come, did you build that after you built the house with the extra lumber?
It was a couple of years later. It was. Yeah, the tree house came a couple of years later. And the shop came as a necessity because we had to have places to store tools and construction supplies while we were building. Mm-hmm. But yeah, getting the loan to build it was one of the biggest challenges. And I didn't anticipate that going in. I thought, you know, if I tell someone I can build a house, and I believed it, with there was no doubt in my mind that we could accomplish this. Mm-hmm. Certainly they'd give me the money to build a house, but that was not the case. The first couple of banks I went to did not exactly laugh out loud at me, but pretty darn close. And I was already in such a place of low self-esteem. Yeah. You know, I had been so beat down to have, you know, professional people who were in this industry look at me and be like, no, you are not a good gamble.
You're not a contractor for sure.
Right. You're not a licensed contractor. There is no way we're giving you the money for this, lady. It was so hard. And if I had been doing this alone, mm-hmm. if this had been just me going out, if I hadn't already brought my kids in and built them up and we had all declared together we were going to do this, I would have given up right there. After the first couple of rejections, I would have not had the guts to keep going with it. But there was no way I could go and tell my kids at that point, you know what, I thought we could do this, but I was wrong, we can't. Mm. Everybody else is right, and we're not capable of this. There was no way I was going to my kids to tell them that. Mm-hmm. So it was time to put on the big girl suit, string on the pearls. Uh-huh. And I walked into a bank like I owned it.
With your red on.
And it was with red. Red was important. It was my power color.
That's right. Power stance.
And I just knew that there was no way I was leaving that bank mm-hmm. until they gave me what I asked for. And I was shaken on the inside. But it was the first sense of, after so many years of feeling powerless in my life, mm-hmm. of not having any control, it was the first time that I felt this inner sense of power. Mm-hmm. And some of it was that, you know, fake it till you make it. But that's an effective strategy. Yeah. You know, when you put your shoulders back, you do feel more powerful, not just look more powerful. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the most important things I ever did, to give myself permission to walk in there with that power. It changed everything. It changed the way that I saw myself, what I was capable of having the courage to ask for something mm-hmm. And to push for it, to push someone who I felt was more powerful than me, stronger than me, to really push them and make them give me what I wanted. And I walked out with more money than I asked for.
Woo-hoo!
So, yeah. And, you know, it was definitely a case of sometimes ignorance takes the place of courage. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what we were in for. Right. I didn't know how hard it was, so I could still be super courageous about it. Mm-hmm. From the first day on the job site and beyond, I knew then what we were in for, and the courage was harder to come by. But at that point, I knew it beyond any shadow of a doubt.
Yes. In your book, and throughout the chapters here, which you're going to want to pick up a copy. Of course, we will have all the links in the show notes for you. And you can go on createyournow.com too if you, for some reason, have lost this episode, which I know you won't, because you're going to want to come back and continue to be inspired by Kara's story. You talk about the smirks of the bankers, the loan officers, but it didn't stop there. You had the smirks also of the hardware, and then the smirks of the ones that, yeah, I mean, you know, the contractors that you asked to help a little bit that you met here and there. Yet you were just oh so powerful. As I read through your journey, your courage, whether you realize or not, got stronger and stronger, Kara.
It did, but you know, there is, when you take on something like this that's so far outside of your experience, there is so much to be said for getting comfortable really on feeling a little stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, for admitting like, yeah, I don't, and laughing at yourself and for admitting like, I mean, I wasn't walking into a plumbing store or to a hardware store like, hey, I got this. I didn't walk in there like I walked into the bank.
Right.
I walked in there extremely humble, willing to laugh at myself, willing to take the smirks a little bit because they were sort of deserved, right? I was an author and programmer, you know, 110-pound weakling going, I can build a house. you know, and you have to recognize that what you're doing might be outside of the norm and a little ridiculous. So pretty early on in the process, you know, by a rude awakening, finding myself slathered in mud, trying to figure out what I was doing, I realized that, okay, this is going to be going on for a long time, this sense of I don't have a clue. So you get the ability to humble yourself and go, hey, every person I meet, whether they work at the hardware store or they just happen to be purchasing something for their toilet, mm-hmm. I am going to ask them questions. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to get every perspective on this. You know, there's a freedom in that, too, of laughing at yourself. And it was something I did not have going in, and my kids did not have going in. When you've been, the lower your self-esteem is, and when you've been that beat down, you're very defensive. Mm-hmm. You're very, you know, if somebody laughs at you, or even the self-deprecating humor is not there, because you want to bow up and go, no, wait, I am strong. I am powerful. I am, you know, you try to wear this false sense of it, where truly the more strength comes in being able to ask for the direction and in being able to laugh at yourself. And when my kids and I got to the point where we could laugh at ourselves, it was an enormous turning point and raise in our self-esteem. Mm. And laugh at each other and not be insulted. Self-deprecating humor, if you can do that, it's a sign of feeling confident. Mm-hmm.
You guys are beginning to build that communication again when it was taken away for you years before.
Right. And that we had so much of it, we had just never developed. Mm. You know, when you're tiptoeing through your life, you're not developing normal family connections, normal family communication. And, you know, what is normal anyhow in our society? But by that, I mean more specifically healthy family communication and healthy connections with each other. And that was something that was definitely missing. And that if you're thrown together on a job site for 19 hours a day for 9 months, you will figure out how to talk to each other. To the point, you know, and at first there were a lot of growing pains in learning, because we didn't know each other. We didn't truly know each other. We all had so many walls built, so many barriers. We didn't know ourselves, let alone one another. Now, and certainly by the end of the construction, we were reading each other's minds. You know, someone would kind of be in the middle of a project and look up and grunt, and we're like, oh, you need this? Here it is. You know, we knew exactly.
Yeah.
And we know each other so well today, and can be very honest and real with one another in a way that most families cannot, because we've had that amount of time together.
Yes. Yeah. There's a bond. It was like you were sheltering yourself, but you had to be willing to unshelter yourself to remove the protection that you had built around you to truly build a relationship, not only with your own family, but then to build a home that you all could actually call home and not be afraid to live your life.
Right. And to build something that is a shelter and safety. Mm. There's something so primitive about that. You know, humans have done that, obviously, from the beginning of time. There's something so primitive about that, that is addressing the most basic of your needs, that once you accomplish that, everything else seems so much easier.
Yeah.
And that being said, while my kids and I communicate in this, I think, extremely healthy way and very real way, that's not to say it's like all positive and easy and good and perfect. Some of the things we're communicating, you know, and we know each other so well that some of the things are communicating are like, you know what you suck at, and yeah, you should probably go in this other direction. Let me handle that. Okay. But we're very real about it.
Right.
You know, and my siblings with each other, as well as with me, like they'll fully tell me, yeah, mommy, you shouldn't do that again. Here's how you can improve that. And I know that they know me well enough, and they have my best interest at heart. They know my goals. Mm-hmm. They know exactly the directions I want to be taking, that if I'm straying from that, or I'm doing something that is completely ineffective and taking me, they're going to tell me. Mm-hmm. They're going to tell me. So, you know, well, positive, healthy communication is not always about positive things.
Yes. Yes. Amen to that. Because I think we do tend to think that everything has to be perfect. And it's not about perfection. It's about accepting each other where we are and living out each step, whether it's negative or positive, but doing it together. Right. Out of love.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be a family. Like, all of those things apply to a team of any kind.
Yes.
You know, a team of coworkers, a team of great friends, you know, a team of people who just get together to talk about their businesses in a mastermind or something. Any sort of a team can go through that same sort of strengthening process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it all starts with the foundation, which I can remember in your story, you had a few hiccups on that foundation, to say the least.
The foundation was without a doubt the hardest part and the longest part of the process, as far as the longest segment of the process. And ironically, when we were imagining building a house, when we were building this model and fantasizing about it, we didn't even know what a foundation was or what went into it. You know, the first thing that we thought of was framing walls. And really, we spent a lot more time thinking about paint color and what color the curtains would be and how we would decorate the house than we ever thought about, you know, how many months are we going to be slogging through mud in the freezing cold, and how weak we were, physically weak, not just the communication and all this emotional stuff that was happening, but physically none of us were construction workers. You know, my oldest was 17 and a girl, and an extremely girly girl who did like beauty pageants. I mean, you could not get more outside of her than touching nature, you know?
Right.
Let alone hauling around concrete blocks and mixing concrete in a wheelbarrow.
And how many blocks were those? Or like 1,500 or so that you moved?
1,500 concrete blocks that we moved multiple times because, you know, huge learning curve on how to do this.
Yes.
And you know, we just did everything wrong. My plumber had no courage at all. That was me in the early stages. And could not figure out how to hook up the water to the city main. And the main courage was I had to bore under the street. And the city had told me, because the main was on the other side of the street. And the city had told me, like, if I do it wrong and I collapse the road, like, that's on me. I got to fix it.
Oh.
So I kept putting that off and putting that off. And of course, I was working full time. I was still a programmer, you know, writing computer software while we were building. So during prime business hours, when I needed to be making these phone calls and figuring it out, I was at the office. So it took me almost 2 months to get water hooked up, which is essential for building a house, and even longer to get electricity hooked up, also essential for building a house. But I had a 9-month construction loan, so I only had 9 months to build the house, or I could default on the loan. So I couldn't not build it just because I didn't have essential things like water and electricity. We still had to build it anyhow.
Yeah.
So we had to make this decision to use the neighbor's pond in December and January when it's freezing cold, even here in Little Rock. And this was walking down the hill with 5-gallon pails and scooping up pond water to hand mix mortar to set 1,500 concrete block, mixing that in a wheelbarrow. And again, freezing cold, no proper equipment. None of us owned work boots. We had pulled plastic bags on our stocking feet and then put on old tennis shoes to try to keep our feet dry in some way. We eventually did, at least Drew and I eventually get work boots. The others slogged around in tennis shoes the whole time. You know, so it was improper gloves from everything that you should have. We're just sort of learning along the way. We didn't even know the names of tools or what tools were available. You know, we were watching YouTube videos to try to learn, you know, how do you set a concrete block and what's that thing he's holding? And then actually going to the store and saying, okay, well, there was this concrete thing and it looks like a pie server. What, you know, where is that? And where can I get one of those?
I need a pie server for my concrete.
And I probably could have used a large pie server and it would have worked well.
They might be a little more expensive though.
Right. But you know, it was so ridiculous how ill-equipped we were for this. But also, again, develop the sense of humor early on. And then that extreme sense of determination. There was no way we were not going to succeed. And one of the ways that we did that was that construction loan that I got was enough money to buy the supplies. It was not enough money to hire whole teams of people to come in and put all of that together for us. So, and that was intentional. Mm-hmm. That was intentional right from the start of, let's sabotage our plan B. Which can be one of the most effective strategies you can give yourself. Don't give yourself a way out. Mm-hmm. If I had enough money in the bank to hire someone to do it, I would have. Without a doubt. If I had had a construction loan that would give me 5 years to build a house, mm-hmm. I would have taken 5 years to build a house. So if the tighter you make your goals mm-hmm. and the more you don't give yourself a way out, I mean, the human spirit is amazing what we can accomplish when you have no other choice. Mm-hmm. So we locked ourselves into that and one way or another. And, you know, and the kids saw it too. Like, there is no way out of this. We have this huge pile of bricks and wood and glue. We got one option here. We want our own room or any room at all. We have to figure out a way to put this together.
And didn't you have a mountain of, is it Donafil? No.
Donafil. Oh. Donafil is a substance from hell. It's a wonderful thing when you're building a house because it serves so many important purposes. Yes. It's powdered granite. Mm-hmm. So it's a very fine gray powder, mm-hmm. finer than sand. And so it packs very well, which is essential. We filled our foundation, a block and fill foundation, which is more than you ever want to or need to know about foundations. Mm-hmm. Just means that we put up a bunch of concrete blocks and then we packed it full of Donafil and poured a slab on top of it. Mm-hmm. But it was a mountain. It was 26 small dump truck loads. And let me tell you, when you start to talk dump trucks, small, big, whatever, 26 of them is a lot.
Yes.
And we had to move almost all of that with shovels to fill the foundation, which is like building a pyramid, which we know is possible because we have seen the finished product. So it is just amazing how much Donafil, a girl with a shovel, can move in like 16 hours. And I remember wishing on a day I had taken a day off work and come out here, and it was this big mountain of Donafil, and it was literally, here's what I'm doing all day long. And I'd built up a little muscle by then because I'd moved a lot of concrete blocks that I'd put in the wrong place and then the wrong place and then the wrong place. So I had a little bit of muscle, but I wished that I had like a before and after picture because it's impressive.
Yeah.
Like, I moved this much dirt in a day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was, and they were certainly, you know, it wasn't us completely alone. We had my parents who are divorced and came at different times each to help. We're a tremendous amount of moral support as well as just physical support. And this figure out thing that both of my parents have of, you know, here's the end product we need to have. None of us know how to do this, but let's figure this out. Mm-hmm. And so when they were there, I wasn't all by myself. It wasn't just me and the kids all waiting for me to tell them that there was someone on my team to help me. And I hired a firefighter too, that I paid $25 an hour to come out and help. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing he did for me is leave whenever I asked him to, because he didn't have a lot of money. And he knew that whenever he showed up, that it was a clock ticking in my head of I'm having to pay him. Mm-hmm. So he would get us started on some projects and stuff. If I was just like, I have no idea where to begin on this, he could get us rolling and then it'd be like, okay, see ya. Time for you to go. I don't have any more money to pay you.
Thank you so much, but I need you to go now.
Get out of here. Which was extremely kind of him. He wasn't an extremely experienced builder. I thought that he was when I first hired him. He sort of billed himself as a really extremely, you know, proficient at this. But truly, he had just assisted a couple of other people in building houses, which was way above my experience level. But not a true contractor for sure. But, you know, it cost him money to drive. He lived quite a ways away. It would cost him quite a bit of money just to drive to help me. Mm-hmm. So the idea that he wasn't like, hey, I have a minimum amount of hours or something was a tremendous help to me.
As I read your book, Care, which all of you are going to want to pick up your own copy of Rise, How a House Built a Family. I could see in there so many God winks. And as you came to the close, because you're in your library now, you're at Inkwell Manor yeah. now, and you're going to want to get a copy of the book because you've got to see the pictures. You've got to see this amazing house that you know, that I know now, what went into it, reading your memoir. But in that, your mother played a very important part. In this.
Definitely.
And I'm very close to my mother, and hopefully I won't cry because I don't want to make you cry. But I know when you finish the home, you got a very difficult phone call.
Yeah, and you know, there was this hope the whole time that we're building. Of course, we're all imagining that day we finish and what that will feel like, and that day that you move in. And of course, you imagine this enormous sense of relief as well as like the celebration, like party, and that you will have kind of some smooth sailing for a while. You've accomplished this enormous thing, and we all think that, you know, life is just going to be that way. It's going to give you some big perks and bonuses for doing something hard. Well, welcome to reality. You know, life is this big roller coaster, and that doesn't end. And you don't get those, you don't get those breaks as often as you like. And yeah, I lost my mom the day we moved into the house. So gone was the sense of there is a break or there is celebration. And instead, here's this other huge, not just trauma, but readjusting of your whole life from the way that you see the world, from the way that you see yourself. Mm-hmm. That's somebody I relied on heavily. And in a domestic violence situation, you don't have lots of friends. Mm-hmm. You become very isolated. So my mom was so often the only person who I talked to about so many things. So to lose that right at this time where I thought life is finally going to get better. And I have had a disabled brother also who had lived with my mom. I just had the one sibling, and mentally he was about 10 years old. So he lived with her. Well, in losing my mom, I of course inherited my brother also, which was another huge life shift of here's, you know, I'm a caregiver for him, you know, a financial difficulty as well as just a logistics difficulty of managing that. So another, you know, one challenge after another, my kids and I then renovated her house, tons of, you know, painting and fixing and getting it ready to sell. And then we renovated another house to move my brother into, and that was ripping out floors and learning all the skills, you know, so, and none of that is in the book. But that's what happened, you know, afterwards, that it was months of living in the house before, I would say about 6 to 8 months before we felt that relief and that celebration and the first sense of accomplishment, that it started to feel like something big. And I know that that sounds ridiculous even when I say it in retrospect, because it should have felt like something big while we were doing it. But it felt like something necessary while we were doing it.
Yes.
And it was something that we were ashamed to be doing. And that seems to be hard to grasp for a lot of people. But if you are low enough in your life that your best and sanest option seems to be building your own shelter, that's not a place to be proud of. For us, it was not. We did not tell people we were building a house. We certainly never imagined I would write a book about it or share it with other people.
Or the world.
We didn't tell people that my coworkers didn't know. The people that, you know, my kids' friends, only their very closest friends knew. And even all of the people who did know, when you say you're building a house, certainly assumed we were doing it in a more traditional way that people do today, and that we were pointing and picking things out, not that we were actually building a house. So it didn't have this sense of, oh, we did something that was sort of big and unusual in an important way, because it does feel important now. But at the time, it certainly didn't. And it was probably 8 months in where, you know, other people started hearing about it and being like, what? You did what? Before we started to think, wow, we're sort of proud that we did this. And you know, it was from that point forward, after some of the healing of losing my mom had happened, that we started to feel that more of a sense of celebration.
Mm-hmm. And more of a sense to call it truly your home.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it still felt like a job site for a bit of time after you move in.
Right.
And it is, because, even though, you know, structurally it's finished and you're still doing those, you know, how it is when you move into any home,
yes.
You know, that there, let's figure out how we're arranging things and save up to buy the bit of furniture we need to really complete this room. You know, like anybody moving into a home, we've had that, and things that we knew when we moved in, well, eventually we'll change this. Like, we left the floors concrete. I had stained the floors because that was an inexpensive option. And I've seen stained concrete that looks absolutely beautiful.
Yes.
But I did this myself. And it looked like I did this myself. So, you know, we spent the next 6 years saving up and planning how we would cover that with tile, which we have now done. And now it is beautiful.
Now it's beautiful. Oh, I can imagine, though. I think it was because in your book, I remember you talking about your concrete floor and you wrote about it.
Yeah.
And it about killed you. But we're not going to tell it you just that. Did. I mean, you know.
Right. I literally almost died doing this floor. And it just, you know, there are so many things like that that you have to sort of before you settle into a house.
Yes.
But without a doubt, I mean, from the first day that we lived here, it feels different than any other house you've ever lived in your life. Mm-hmm. When you have built every inch of it, when every piece of everything inside of the walls, from gas lines to plumbing to wood to nails, you've touched. Mm. It's a really, really different sort of a feeling to build something that is physically larger than yourself.
Yeah.
Like, how often do we do that? Even sculptors or painters, you know, that is physically bigger that you have to stand and look way up at. That's a powerful thing.
Mm-hmm. Very powerful. And you're an extraordinary woman. And if anybody is complaining right now that they have too much to do, hopefully they're going to have a little bit different perspective, especially when they finish reading your book, Rise, because it did build. I mean, you did build more than a house. You truly completed your family, and there was healing throughout this whole process. I have to ask a question. I don't want to dive deep into it because I got to leave it as a teaser, but is Caroline's. Is her nail still hanging in your office?
It is.
It is.
Yes, okay. It is. It's actually in the den next door.
Oh, okay. Well, they'll have to read the book to understand what I'm talking about. But I had to ask that question because I know that nail is something that, you know, it's been important to you throughout your story in writing. And as I said before, your journey, I know it's only just begun. And I feel like we should be playing that music. It's only just begun because you have been gifted. You were gifted as an optimist. I cannot imagine, Kara, if you were one who just decided, I'm going to sit back and I'm just going to take life as how it comes to me. But instead, you took action. You took aim and said, I'm going to make a difference one way or the other. And look what you have done. Not only have you built this gorgeous house, Inkwell Manor, your home, but you have built your family up stronger than it has ever been.
And it was so important that, like, I'm not anyone special. Mm. I am not a big, strong, physically strong person. I certainly went and let life take me all sorts of negative places before that. It was a conscious decision to say, we're going to take physical action to build ourselves a better life. You know, and I went through a lot before I got there. And if I can do this, anybody can. Mm-hmm. Literally anybody. It just takes that setting that big goal and deciding that you're not going to be content anymore with these little baby steps. Mm-hmm. You know, that's too often the message that we get and that we give other people. Just do something small. Just do one little thing and eventually you'll reach your goal. When usually, I mean, if you're making a big enough goal, that's ridiculous because a baby step, no matter how many you pile up, will never take you there. Mm-hmm. You have to make these big leaps. And it was just learning that and just deciding that I was not going to settle for that. And no matter what your goal is, it may not be building a house, but no matter what it is, you know, if I can do this, if I can do something so much bigger and that everybody said was impossible, there's no doubt that anybody can.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to touch base real quick before, as we begin to wind down here, you are a survivor of domestic abuse and violence. What would you say to someone who's listening that may be or has been in that situation? Because I know this is somewhat where your heart is too. What would you tell them as a way to either how to escape, how to begin to get out of the survival mode and begin living their life again?
Absolutely. The first thing is to value yourself, value yourself and your kids enough to know that you deserve and can have something better. Mm-hmm. and then it is to get safe. And that is so much harder to do than people realize. You know, there's always the advice, why don't they just leave? Why do they stay? You are so much more likely to be killed or severely hurt after you leave. 75% of the women who are killed in a domestic violence situation are killed after they have left their abuser. That is the most dangerous time. So get yourself safe in a way that you have a support group. And if you don't have a family or friend support group, and most victims have been pulled away and isolated from that, go to the local shelter, because they know how to get you safe and get your kids safe for the long term until you can start rebuilding. So that is the first step. Don't try to start rebuilding or taking these big steps when you're still in danger. You have to get to that healing point. Where you know I'm safe from all of this before you can rebuild. And then it's just to hang up those baby steps and take a leap. You have to do something big enough that it will change the way that you see yourself. Change your perspective of yourself. And small things won't do that. You know, run a marathon. That changes the way you see yourself, if that's your thing. Running, not my thing. I'd build a house any day over running a marathon. But whatever your thing is, you know, find it. Climb a mountain and do it. If you're in a situation like that with other people, with children, or with any, even with other adults, whoever you're with, do it with them. Heal with them. They went through it with you. Heal together. And I think that's such an important thing. We have sort of glamorized the idea of taking a solo trip to the beach or across Europe, you know, in this lovely way that nobody has, who has that much time to do that all by themselves. I mean, in real life, we, most of us have other connections to, you know, spouses, children, family, parents, whatever. Do it with somebody, make it a team effort. Even with other people who have gone through something similar, if you are truly alone. You know, do it in some way that you're building a long-term support team.
Thank you so much for that, because there are some subjects we just kind of want to brush under the carpet, hide the dust bunnies, pretend they don't exist. And when you read your story, it exists. Domestic violence is very real, and we need ones that haven't ever been exposed to that, praise the Lord, but ones who have, we need to be able to help them and reach out and to provide safety for them. And it's just something we don't talk about. So thank you so much, Kara, for shining a light on this.
Yeah, it's a really tough thing. We're getting better at it, but we have a long way to go.
Indeed. Well, I know people are going to want to get in touch with you. So where can they find you?
My website is the best place to connect. I'm at KaraBrookins.com. And from there, you can get me on all social media. But my favorite is Twitter. I'm a tweeter, and I'm there maybe more often than I ought to be. But I absolutely love it. That's my second home.
Oh, well, that's nice to know that's your second home. And of course, yeah. We will have all the information in the show notes for Rise, How a House Built a Family. You are going to want to pick up your own copy. The stories that are in here are riveting. They will change your life. They will empower you from the inside out. And I don't speak of that lightly. In reading what Kara wrote, and with every word, how she connected it from one chapter to the next, from the rise to the fall. It was a roller coaster ride, but it's one that I am so glad that she took the time, the year, 6 years, I believe, to actually finally finish and bring to us. Thank you so much, Kara, for bringing your life's journey so far.
Oh, thank you for sharing it.
Well, I have, you know, the whole series is called My Strength is My Story. So as we begin to wind down, I have one question for you. How has your story gifted you?
In knowing myself. And I would have told you that I knew myself so well prior to this. And, you know, of course, we think of things like that too often as being sort of a narcissistic thing, and knowing myself and learning myself. But no, like, you cannot do anything for anyone else until you have that. And writing your story down, whether you ever plan to share it with other people, truly exploring and writing your own story down, it will change and expand what you can do for the world and what you have to offer.
So beautifully spoken And I know it's going to be beautifully written because I'm quoting you on it, girl. It has been truly my honor to have you here. And I know there's probably going to be more books yet to come. So I'm going to open it up right now. When you're ready, we would love to have you back. I would love to have you back as a guest so we can chat again.
Definitely.
Awesome. Wonderful. Any last thoughts before we head out?
No, just go build something big.
Amen. Go build something big. We'll do it. Thank you so much, Kara. Many blessings to you.
Thank you.
Feeling inspired, ready to train for life, and love your journey? Visit createyournow.com for more incredible resources to help you along the way. We'll see you next time on Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. And remember, always be sure you consult your physician before beginning any health and fitness plan.